C-K-K-U-T-T.
In 1974, I started to get into the gay community and in organizing, I joined CHAT, the Community Homophile Association of Toronto. We couldn't use the word gay back in those days. And I represented CHAT at what was called the Don District Interagency Group, composed of hospitals, YMCA, Red Cross, churches, all the different organizations in downtown Toronto. And the question I raised was, why isn't there services after hours? And there wasn't. So we proceeded to reorganize everybody, hospitals, community groups, churches, and so on, to be able to give 24-hour service. And it was done by this person representing a gay organization. So I not only succeeded, but I felt it was easy to do. And when I moved to Montreal with Walter in 76, I joined the Gay Montreal Association, which was a big organization, and they used to run dances at McGill to raise money, and McGill stopped that. It was part of the internalized homophobia at the time. And we were at the drop-in on St. Fermi Street, and we moved to the Unitarian Church, which at that point was downtown, and we ran activities from there, and doctors and nurses and different people getting involved with other social things. So I started volunteering with what was called the Ville Marie Social Service Center, which was, at that point, there were social service centers before the CLSCs were created. And I represented on the council gay groups, and I was accepted so much so that they offered me a job in the social service sector. And so I got into that, working on welfare rights and low-income issues and so on. So that was my beginnings of entry into the social service industry, as I'll call it, because it was so big and varied and has got even worse now. And one of the highlights of social services in Quebec is the constant change. Every 10 years, they redo the network and make it so different that we are now living through that again with the current government bringing in the social service control over all the organizations, the SUSs and CLSCs and hospitals and nursing homes and so on under one roof. I was elected to sit on the Regional Access Committee for access to English services was set up in each district on the province, and we are in Montreal where we represent or we control 10 institutions, 5 SUSs and hospitals and Pinel and so on. And under the new law, which is controlling of English, we will have a role in protecting Anglophone services. So that's the reason I'm still on that, because I represent gay organizations in the community in general, and I can have an influence, and that's part of what I do, is doing that. When AIDS began to raise its ugly head, the doctors, Dr. Nob Gilmore from the Royal Victoria Hospital, Chris Soukas from the Montreal General and so on, came to me and asked me to help a response from the community. I was well known in the network, and so that's why I was contacted. And I created MARC ARMS, Montreal AIDS Resource Committee, which was the first AIDS organization. And I based it on SAGE, Seniors in a Gay Environment, in New York City, and the Terence Hegan Trust in London. I visited both of those to do my research before I set up MARC ARMS. And these were gay organizations giving services to non-gays. This was revolutionary at the time. How dare that gay organizations can actually deal with non-gay people? And so I was in the vanguard of that, but there was opposition both inside and outside. My first real example of homophobia in Montreal was some of the volunteers at MARC ARMS decided to form CSAM, or a non-gay organization to be able to give services to people with HIV, and the government, of course, leaned in that direction as opposed to giving money to a gay organization. So that was my first experience of homophobia within our own community, people not feeling comfortable that we could actually look after ourselves. When I started working in the hospitals, there are certain floors to certain hospitals, certain head nurses, which were more receptive than to others, and I had to maneuver amongst the different hospitals and different floors to be able to organize a response. There was such a thing in that point as when people were in the hospital, they wore what was called the AIDS uniform. You couldn't see anybody because we were all gowned and masked up and so on. This was a problem because people at that point lived maybe a couple weeks, didn't live very long. And I resented going in to see somebody and sitting with them while they died and they couldn't even see a human being. So I got rid of the AIDS uniform. And I had support from the head nurse and others to help make this a more human sort of response. And when you're dealing with people who were dying in your arms, you wanted to be able to have some human contact. And that became really important because, as I said, there were no drugs. AZT wasn't developed till a few years later in the early 90s. And when it was first given out, they killed people because the doses were way too high. Well, they didn't know at that point. They had to do a trial and error, and people were the ones who suffered. But AIDS people were desperate for anything that had this a sense of hope to it. It did begin to work, but we developed, because the institutions were not giving services, except in isolated cases, like Six Medical of the Royal Vic and so on. CLSCs were just being created. Social service centers were being destroyed in order to create the CLSC network. So we at ACCM, which was another successor organization to CSAM, the Anglophones broke away from CSAM because CSAM wasn't giving services in English. And so ACCM was created in 89, actually. And we organized a parallel system. I had a social service department of 40 people, doctors, psychiatrists, psychologists, nurses, occupational therapists, all kinds of different people we could use to support people dying at home. So this was a buddy service system, which they still have, and which we are trying to create a similar sort of a much smaller response to Gay and Gray in the sense of dealing with isolated people and giving them supports.
You mentioned Mark Arms, CSAM, and ACCM. Can you give us a historical background as to how those three organizations came to be?
Mark Arms was the first AIDS organization, Montreal AIDS Resource Committee in English, that was created to, in response to requests from doctors in the various hospitals, to have a community response, because in the early days of AIDS, and HIV wasn't even thought of at that point, people were dying quickly and all over the continent, and different cities had different responses. I based Mark Arms on SAGE, Seniors in a Gay Environment, which was a gay organization in New York City that created the gay men's health crisis, response to the AIDS by the gay people giving services to not only gays but to non-gays, since AIDS didn't limit itself just to gay people, even though the publicity at the time was it was a gay disease or it became a Haitian disease or the hemophiliacs were the good victims because they had the blood clotting factor that they could get from blood, and if it was infected, it was because of gay people. So there's lots of discrimination floating around and shame and we had to fight all that at the same time, fighting to keep people alive, or trying to give them what little dignity we could at the time, because when it first started out, there was no cure. People lived for days or weeks at most once they were diagnosed, and different things cropped up. If you had these spots on your face and your body, it was one of the more obvious signs, but that was not the only response medically that people dealt with pneumonia. All things that were not known, or were known in very isolated situations, that seniors would get, but nobody else would get, but it sort of manifests itself with people with AIDS. We found out after a while the virus, HIV, so we at Mark Arms we created two different groups. One, a support group for people with full-blown AIDS, and two, a support group for people who had just been diagnosed. And when AZT came about in the early 90s, we were able to have two different kinds of support because there were two different kinds of issues. One was death and dying. The other one was possible death, but coping and how to deal with what was thrown in front of you with all the discrimination, how to get access to services. And so CSAM, being born a couple of years after Mark Arms was born, this would be around 87. Mark Arms was born in 83, gave services starting in 84, and Montreal had the first in 85 national conference of AIDS organizations and professionals like the Red Cross and so on, funded by the federal government, in order for the country to have an organized response. We created the national organization that still exists in Ottawa for AIDS. And there was a number of initiatives, but they were based on local characteristics, whether it's ACT in Toronto or Bill Ryan, who came from Halifax representing the gay organization there. He's now a professor at School of Social Work at McGill. So we had different people in different places. Some of the leaders went on to become major public figures, like the person from Winnipeg became its mayor and became a cabinet minister in the government in Ontario. So all these leaders across the country who were heading the response came from nothing to go on to become major leadership figures in public service across the country, which is one of the beneficial side effects. ACCM, AIDS Community Care of Montreal, was born in 89 because CSAM was not giving proper services to people who spoke English. And so they broke away from there. And CSAM died shortly thereafter because their DG ran off with $50,000 of money and corrupted the organization. So ACCM became the thing because the government wasn't funding Mark Arms, and CSAM got into financial difficulties, so ACCM became the only viable organization which still exists and still gives services. And people who are members of Gay and Grey started out as members of AIDS Community Care of Montreal. We just lost one, a member of our board of directors, Ray, who was one of the first clients. I had met Ray when I was at Ville-Marie Social Service Center, and he and his mother were clients of the system. And so I got to know him as a child, early teenager, and we grew and became friends. And this was a common sort of thing because you got so close to people, because dealing with death and dying, you cross borders. And as a professional, you have to be not only empathetic, but understanding. And you develop, by being open, good relationships. Sometimes they become friends or over time, and Ray was an example of that. And this happened with many of the people, but people didn't survive for many long periods, because even with AZT coming around, it still was only a stopgap situation. So we're still busy putting Band-Aids, medically speaking, on, trying to keep people alive. And by hook or by crook, some did, some didn't. But we still have had hundreds of people that started out with Mark Arms and CSAM and ACCM have died. I have records of over 300 plus people who died with lots in my arms. And there was this continual fight for acceptance. As I mentioned earlier, it was GRID, the gay disease, and then it became, when the Haitians were infected for some reason, it became a black disease, and then hemophiliacs started getting infected because the blood clotting factor they need to survive comes from blood, and some of it was tainted, and so they got infected, but they were the worthy victims. It wasn't through their fault. It wasn't in sexual activity, which the gay community was constantly being accused of. So they were the okay victims. So you had two different acceptances in the public's eyes, and we had to fight over that. The community response from ACCM was to create a parallel system, since community CLSCs and so on were not giving services or were just being created and didn't have services. And so we had to create not only a depot kind of thing where we could store equipment, hospital beds, walkers, everything and anything, so we could take care of somebody with our volunteers 24 hours a day in their home, and we did that. We had a social service department of doctors and nurses and so on of 40 plus people as an example, and this was all volunteers from, as I mentioned, psychiatrists, psychologists, nurses from all over the place, people who were, some were gay, some were lesbian, obviously. Some were just allies and wanted to help and felt that we should be doing as a community and have a much better sort of support response.
Can you describe what the early patients had to endure when they were first diagnosed?
When you were first diagnosed, you were placed in isolation, and they did that at the Royal Vic or the Montreal General or the St. Luke or the Hotel Dieu in very isolated areas on particular floors. So they could, it wasn't meant to be isolation in a bad sense, it was meant to be able to have a organized response of all the different services the hospital could offer. But people didn't survive long, and when you had to, if you were allowed to visit them, you had to have what was called the AIDS uniform, a mask, gowns, gloves, shoe covers, head covers. So when you saw somebody, it was like you were a figment of their imagination. You didn't know, because all you could see was maybe their eyes. And we in the community had decided, and some of the professionals in the hospitals, nurses and so on, that this was unacceptable, that this was inhuman. And if people were dying, we wanted to be able to have a sort of a human sort of contact. So we started by disappearing the uniform and going in, which was in hindsight a risk in some ways, but it allowed a human face for those who may only live for a few hours.
The patients, there was a great amount of fear in the community, not only our community, but the community at large, and the support staff that were working on these floors. I understand that there were times when meals weren't being delivered, and if you were alone, in other words, your family had abandoned you, people may be in the room for days on end without any contact until your organization actually came to help. Can you explain a little bit more about that?
It depended on what floor you were put on. If you were put on, like, 6 medical at the Royal Vic, an example, the head nurse would refuse to allow that to happen. But if you were on another floor which didn't have the experience or the content, people would leave the trays of food outside the door. The cleaners wouldn't go in and clean the room because they were afraid touching something. There was this fear that AIDS, HIV, was so easily transmitted, things like touching a doorknob. So people had a major fear because there was so much misinformation. And we had to train professionals to respond. one thing, for instance, Donna Snowden and I wrote a book, AIDS, a handbook for professionals, try to teach various kind of professionals how to receive people with HIV and how to respond to them and then deal with their fears. This happened throughout the system when, an example, with Nazareth House wanted to set up an AIDS hospice, the community, this was the downtown Shaughnessy Village area, rose in response out of fear. And so we had to organize, bring in people like Nobby Gilmore, have community meetings to deal with their fears, their questions. So this was a lot of time, but this was done on a volunteer basis. This was not done by government or institutions. This was done by us to deal with the fears. There still wasn't the kind of funding or training in the professional networks, which happened, but only happened once the social service centers were disbanded in 93 and everybody in those networks just transferred, like myself, to CLC. So we were able to be on the inside and make sure the response and training was done. So this took years to have incremental steps. In the meantime, people lived or didn't and had to deal with so much, not only misinformation, but discrimination and fear and isolation. And so we in the community responded wonderfully. If it wasn't for gay people and lesbians in particular responding to the cries for help and volunteering, we couldn't have done 24-hour care. And we were doing 24-hour care for lots of people in their homes, helping people die in their homes. We had made arrangements with the Mount Royal Cemetery, for instance, a wonderful man who headed it. People who died didn't have any money, so they would cremate them and we would bury them. The mountain has AIDS people scattered in various places. I know where. And one of the things I have to make sure that I do is write down some of these places. I've had a recent request from Windsor, for instance, where, in a particular case, where is this person scattered or buried, and can I go and see them? And I know where different people, whether mostly Americans or people that had been abandoned by their family, different places were done. John Molson would probably be up in arms if he knew some people were scattered on their mausoleum. But we're around, but I have to make sure I record some of that so this kind of history doesn't get lost in the shuffle. I'm feeling more and more of that kind of pressure and responsibility to make sure I write down some of these things, because I, for instance, have the names of 300 plus people in the early stages who died. Nobody else has that information, and I want to make sure that that doesn't get lost. I've had requests, because I did intake forms for people with AIDS and for people with HIV. They were different. And I've had a request from a professor in Trinity and in Ireland to help with my nephew in Windsor to help do the research based on these forms that nobody has done. It's primary information that we have that nobody's looked at, and I want to make sure that some of those things get done on a level before I die, that this information not only doesn't get lost, but gets spread out for other people to make use of it.
It sounds like you want to create something like they did in the States with the panels type thing. Not necessarily panels, but just a recorded history of what these people had to endure in the early stages of the AIDS, yeah, HIV epidemic.
I look at, for instance, Toronto, 519 Church, which is their community center, and their AIDS thing outside. They have panels, plaques, and so on you can find and so on. Our AIDS park here, it's been recently developed a little bit to make it more pleasant to look at, but it's really doesn't allow for a memory to be recorded. There's no place in Montreal where we can put something to say that person A died here in 1984, because there's we haven't organized that kind of response, which is unfortunate for the community. They go and see this park, and it's really a major disappointment as far as memory goes. You bring your memories with you because the park doesn't help you with that at all.
Do you have any specific memories of one or two people that you might have encountered that moved you or you felt particular?
So many. One of the things we did was create for people with AIDS and HIV. We started out by having what's called drag yourself to dinners, where we would, a group of us would get together and cook a wonderful dinner and entertain each other, have drag shows. We would learn how to do drag, just a way to have fun. And out of that grew the CLG Foundation, which was a foundation dedicated to give money that they would raise for recreational activities, because people with AIDS or HIV might be getting some professional services, but if they were abandoned by their family and or the community in general, they were isolated and no way to have any sorts of sense of fun. So we would fund shows. We did our first show at the Belgium Club in Montreal, and I did a teddy bear's picnic sort of comedy sort of thing, and my husband was just rolling on the floor in laughter. It was so funny. I love doing comedy, and I'm good at doing comedy. And we called the board of governors, board of directors, we were all goddesses. So we had all these different names, ways to try to have fun, and why you were still able to have the strength to do, you could join us and do some of those activities. And so, for instance, I wear around my neck and my name in Egyptian. One of the first people that I remember was this young man who was from Egypt, and he was so happy with how the different ways we organized to help him. He made me my name in Egyptian. And I wear that every day as a memory of him. If you go into some of the archives at ACCM, or I've donated most of my archives to the Quebec Gay Archives, there are lots of pictures and stories of different people who we helped in a psychological level and who responded, and we have their stories, and I want to make sure that those kinds of things are available, but at the moment they're hidden in the archives because I'm the only person that has them, but people are able to consult that. But the trouble with the archives is they need more staff, need more money to hire people. I have donated truckloads of stuff, and they need to hire a person just to go through all the stuff that I've donated, but they don't have these kinds of resources because they don't have that kind of funding yet, unfortunately. But it's there, so eventually we'll get there. Every day, remember, I feel a responsibility to remember different people that I've worked with over the years. And I love seeing some of those faces and the smiles and knowing what they went through and what I was able to share with them. So that's been a source of strength and joy for me to be able to share those memories. And I want to do it in a more organized sort of fashion so other people can also have access to those kinds of things.
Sounds like there's a project in the brewing there.
Yes, there is.
Montreal's medical community, how prepared were they when the news of the virus started rolling down? In North America, the first cases of HIV were in 1980, while there is proof that HIV existed years and years prior, because blood samples had been taken from people and they were tested at a later date. The first case in Montreal was somewhere between 82 and 83. So how prepared was the medical community and the social service community to help these people through that time?
Totally unprepared. There was a commitment from certain doctors like Nobby Gilmore at the Royal Vic, or Chris Soukas at the Montreal General. And we coalesced to force the system to respond. Chris Tsoukas at the Montreal General, his first office was literally a closet, and you had to go in sideways to be able to sit down. So the system was not willing to put money into giving services, but individual doctors forced the system to respond. And it's only because of them and the community, in case of Mark Arms, that coalesced together with what professionals we could find in French and English to make the system a little more responsive to the needs. That opened the doors, but it was a long struggle over years to have the professional system not only respond, but be trained to respond. There was no training being offered. One of the first things that we recommended from the 1985 conference, when we had all the AIDS organizations that existed in those early years together, was to ask for proper funding at federal and provincial levels to help the various professionals, whether it's nurses or occupational therapists or orderlies. Different kinds of people have different kinds of training, and the whole gambit was a team. So whether you were the cleaner going into that room, if that didn't function, then the whole rest of the system wasn't able to function. So we had to make sure not only the professionals were able to respond, but the support staff felt comfortable and supported so they could respond. So we developed training mechanisms, and it took years, but it was successful, but it took years for the system to have an organized response. But it was because people like me in Villemarie Social Service Center were allowed and supported because we had a supportive leadership, gay or allied leadership in the social service network. And I remember one of the first cases was a woman who had a young child and she was dying. And Villemarie Social Service Center had taken the responsibility for the child and put him in foster care. So we had to create a foster care network of home to create the supports. And because I supported the natural parents, we had to make sure that the woman herself wasn't cut out or cut away from allowing to see her son, because there were fears about transmission and so on. So all kinds of basic stuff had to be done, but we had supportive management who wanted also to make some of that happen. That was because individuals, not because the government had a plan, it's because individuals were willing or demanding that the system respond in a more meaningful sort of manner in the whole gambit of what was needed.
How long did you work with HIV/AIDS community as a social worker? Was that ongoing for many years? Were you around in 96 when the first medications were approved to combat the disease?
It was before 96.
Well, you had AZT before that, but 96 was when
ARCH came along.
Yeah.
I, in my various hats, whether I was at the Villemarie Social Service Center, and all social service centers were abandoned in 1993, and all the staff in the various social service centers, Montreal had one English, one French, and one Jewish. In the other territories, it was just one per territory. We had three for the different language groups or religious groups. When those were abandoned, and I went to the CLSC, I was still allowed to work, but I was on the inside. So the CLSC was supportive of me having AIDS clients. And the thing about AIDS clients was a lot of their needs were similar to seniors' needs. And that was beneficial in the sense of helping other people respond, because they had an idea what seniors' services were needed, and so they could complement and create similar sort of things for people with HIV. And that was an important thing, but I remember my caseload in those days was 35 clients per worker. The caseload now, and this is 2024, is 70.
Wow.
So you can imagine a social worker these days has not only very limited time to respond, but under the law, for instance, if somebody needs a place in a network from the hospital, the social worker in the CLSC has only 3 days to respond, and if they don't respond, they get fined. So there's a lot of dumping going on wherever they can find a bed, whether it's in a shelter or in a proper facility. And with so many private nursing homes being abandoned these days, the network is clogged with people that need services but can't find any. So with this problem that we dealt with back in the early 90s is not only continued, but it's got worse. But the acceptance for people with HIV and the medical advancements these days, AIDS is not a death sentence. AIDS has become more of a chronic illness in a sense, and you can take various kinds of medications that will keep it at bay or will hide the virus so you can live and have a normal life and you can have children. One of the major things at the beginning was women were afraid that they couldn't have children if they were HIV. There was so much misinformation and discrimination. So we've grown in some ways, but we still have other ways have fallen backwards.
The term HIV identified sometime in the mid-80s, 85, 86. And at that point in time, the American CDC changed the name of the disease from GRID, gay-related immune disease, to AIDS, acquired immune deficiency syndrome. This was in response to people outside of the gay community being infected and more or less gave them a pass. And the stigma that continues to this day is mostly towards people who are of the gay community. So what kinds of things can we do to mitigate the stigma that still remains?
Well, to start with the stigma, you had to fight between the Americans and the French over who founded the virus. It turned out to be the French had the more accurate response, but the Americans had to be first. And then we had this fight within the professional communities, and we had the political situation when Reagan was president as an example of who would never give services to people with AIDS. And so not only you're trying to fight to survive, but the larger picture is the professionals were fighting amongst each other for credit and money and would not acknowledge that somebody else might have done something in parallel or might have been in the leadership function like the French. So it took a while for that to resolve, and until that was resolved, the professional responses were muted. It was only once they accepted that the French actually found the HIV virus and how it was created and so on, and that we learned, as you mentioned earlier in the show, that the initial response was people with AIDS, but we were able to go back because we had blood samples. We traced it back into the 60s and 50s to that this virus was already there, but we didn't know it. Discrimination, it was an adjective that went with AIDS, HIV, because there was so much fear and misinformation that discrimination accompanied it. And it only was much later that it was when the fear disappeared and people were able to have medical responses that allowed them to survive, that kind of thing has disappeared. And now you can get services and you can get a medical response and you can have drugs that will hide the virus in your system to allow you to live a normal life, which was, when we first started out, unheard of, a dream. We only had death to look forward to. It was a matter of time if it was either going to be weeks, months, or if you're lucky, you might get some years out of it. But there was no sense of a cure, no sense of a long-term life. So people gave up, and you would have people who were thought they would die would max out their credit card and so on, because why bother? So there was a lot of different kinds of individual responses depending on their own individual situation, and we had to be able, in as volunteers at ACCM, to deal with all of them because nobody else was. And we had to create, one of the things, for instance, I did was have a monthly support system for all the nurses and doctors in the hospitals so they could talk about death and how that affected them and their giving of services. The system didn't care if you how you responded or not. They just wanted their stats. But we cared about, if you don't take care of people giving services, then they're going to burn out and not being able to give, and now who's going to replace them? And we were worried particularly about doctors, because there were so few that were willing to give services in English or in French, that we wanted to make sure that we kept them, because they were under such pressure. If we lost even one, it would have a major, major impact in the community, because we had so few of them. They were in the handful, and we would have like one person at the Vic, or one person at the Chest Hospital, or at the Shum, as it's called now, St. Luke, or Hotel Dieu, or at the Montreal General. You're talking about one person per institution, and that was just unheard of. But that's how it started, and we had to develop supports, and some of those people are still there. One of them, Dr. LeBlanc, just recently retired. One of the few that's left, there's only Chris Soukas at the Montreal General that's still around from the original beginnings. And we have people that are subsequent to that. Dr. Zabo, for instance, at the Clinique L'Actuelle, was hired as a second generation of people giving services. And he's now relying on a few of those people that are still there. Réjean Thomas from the Clinique L'Actuelle was the ones at the beginning, and he didn't speak any English at the time. And I remember when we first did a radio show together, he knew the importance of being able to respond to Anglophones, and he learned English as a result of that. And he's still there giving services, and he's still there giving leadership, and still there fighting for these issues, and has acknowledged the changes over time, but also acknowledges the situation that there's still within the community, as soon as you raise the issue of HIV, people are afraid. Even though we know the transmission is controlled, there's still in the background, all we've been through in the community, it still taints our response for that.
As a social worker, did you get involved with the partners of people who were dying? Because they were going through issues as well. For example, if you were a partner of someone who was dying and you had to bury the person, you had funeral homes that were denying service, you had churches, synagogues refusing services. Did you get involved with any of the grief that these people were going through?
Absolutely. And that's how I first met Arlen Bonner, for instance, who was pastor at the Montreal General in the early days. And it became very clear to me that a spiritual response was important. People wanted, if they're facing death, wanted to know that they had the support of God, for instance, or that they were not going to go to hell. And so we organized how to deal with spiritual stuff. Arlen Bonner was and still is helping with that process. But we would, for instance, the Jews, no rabbi would deal with it. So I had to get an Anglican minister to deal with Jewish people who were dying, because we couldn't get a Jewish response organized. Muslims, I had to go to mosques. The non-medical response, the support to partners, was very, very important, because if you don't have your own network to fall back upon and that you can sustain that network in one way or another, then you might die totally alone or without that kind of support. And so we at ACCM at those early days wanted to make sure that not only we were supporting the professionals who were giving services, but the network, such as it was for each individual, that we could help them. And so our buddy support system was a model for that kind of support, and we picked out certain places. I mentioned the Mount Royal Cemetery, Cane and Federley, where Jane Blanchard still exists. Jane was the head of Buddy Support Services at ACC in those days when I was head of social services. And so she's still in the network. When Ray died, I contacted her because Ray was on social assistance, estranged from his family, nobody was willing to step up. And she called and said, I'm still here. I still have, but I'm sure other professionals in the network still have contact with certain individuals in certain services that we could call and be supportive. It doesn't always work that way. For instance, the last president of the CLG Foundation, John, he died from a heart attack. He had asked us to be buried with his partner in the cemetery at Honor Gilberti in Saint Laurent. After he died, the family objected. So we could bury ourselves, but we couldn't let anybody know we were there. So there's still, in this day and age, still fear and opposition to what people might want to do in helping support their transition to another life, or into the next room, as I call it. And so what we think we might have accomplished all those years ago, we still run into in this day and age. Even with all the advances, there's still fear and ignorance that are out there.
Because the community response was so required that there was nothing from governments or medical profession or anything like that, the queer community rose up, and in New York and San Francisco, movements like ACT UP were created. Were you involved at all with the movement here in Montreal?
Periphery. When I went to the first conference in 87, that World Conference on AIDS, ACT UP was there. And I was representing ACCM at the time, and so I was very involved, but I had to limit different things I could do because I was having a full-time job and a full-time volunteer and going back to school, because I did go back to school in order to acquire more pieces of paper. I've got four of them now, well, five of them actually. And so I didn't join ACT UP specifically because I just didn't have the time, but I supported, and I was at this conference when they came and demonstrated and stopped the whole conference to call people's attention to combat Reagan's response of disappearing. People with AIDS didn't deserve services. So we had to deal with not only familial situations and professional sort of situations, we had to deal with governmental situations and world views, because leaders in the world were not supportive of opening up their services. I remember sitting down with Pierre-Marc Johnson, who was premier of Quebec at the time, and he was in a re-election bid. And I talked to him, and I talked to him in English. And he responded in English, and he understood, and he was very supportive and still is. And so you pick and choose where you might find allies, because you never know who they might be. And you might think somebody is opposed to that, but when you actually get an opportunity to present a situation, you can help change their minds and, as a response, open up government funding. And we did that both with the Liberals on the federal level and the PQ on the provincial level, even the Liberals to some extent, but the PQ was much more responsive than other parties in Quebec. So it varies from place to place. So you have to pick out your allies. And we were able to do that for different reasons. I was head of Phi Kappa Pi, which is Canada's only national fraternity. And I was national president, and I used that. The premier of Prince Edward Island was a member of the fraternity, so I was able to get direct contact with a leader in order to deal with how that particular province could respond. So you use the tools that are available, and I was smart enough to have a variety of different tools and knew how to manipulate the system in a positive way to make sure people with AIDS, HIV were looked after, not only by us, but by the various professional responses, and to get them to be more accommodating. It took time, but it was successful.
We're going to end this interview, but I'd like to give you the opportunity to have some final words, some memories that you want to share, or anything that you would like to say.
I treasure memories in particular, and I think I'm lucky to have so many memories that helped sustain me through this. I felt a kindred spirit, not only as a gay person, but as a professional. I had a philosophy that clients came first, staff came second, and the system came third. The government response was totally inverted. I was able to force the system, because of the quality of who I am, to make sure the client, I got into shit because the clients didn't necessarily come first. And so I got into hot water sometimes, but I never deviated from the fact that clients always should come first, and whatever a professional is doing, putting the client first. And when I had cancer and I needed help, the shoe was on the other foot, and I had to learn to accept help. And all the work that I had done over the years, all of a sudden, all these people volunteered to help me, driving me daily to the hospital for treatment, or taking me home, or taking me to get medications, all these different people. So I felt rewarded in the sense of all the things I have done. I made an impact, and I had the lucky that I was able to have some of these people respond when I needed help. You never know what you're going to do. Once you plant a seed, it can grow, and it will manifest itself in various positive ways, and you just have to be open to acknowledge that. And I was lucky, and I still consider myself lucky, to be part of a system that I can make friends, which is one of the reasons I joined Gay and Gray. It helped me break out of my isolation, and I've been rewarded by finding new friends and new supports. The power of one. One person can make one change, however small, and it's important to accept that the small changes can begin to roll and make bigger changes, but you have to start with the small changes. Everybody can make a contribution, and I hope and support that you will think about the power of one. Make a positive change in not only your life, but in somebody else's life by just acknowledging and saying hello to somebody, or giving some money to a foundation that might help with food delivery, as an example. Different things. It doesn't have to be specific, just has to be something positive. And I hope and pray that that's a concept I would leave for the future.
Thank you, David, for sharing your knowledge and intimate experience with the HIV/AIDS community. Over the many years, we're going on to 40 plus years of dealing with this disease. People are still dying from AIDS,
yes.
And it's still here. There is no cure. Safer sex is an option that people should consider when being intimate. I want to thank David
for sharing his story. We are sad to report the passing of one of our guests in the Queer Elder Sharing podcast series. Chloe Vio passed away on April 1st from complications due to a stroke. She was a strong voice for the trans community, and she will be missed. You can view her interview on our YouTube channel. Gay and Gray Montreal is a social mutual aid and sensitization network for English-speaking 2S LGBTQIA+ individuals who are 50 years old or older in the metropolitan Montreal area. We are committed to reducing the isolation and improving the quality of life for queer seniors while promoting appropriate services in a positive, caring environment for two-spirited, lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans, queer, intersex, asexual, and anyone who identifies as belonging within the rainbow umbrella. If you have any questions or comments about this radio program, please email us at info@gayandgraymontreal.com. That's Gay and Grey Montreal, all one word, GayandGreyMontreal.com. Please state Gay and Grey Live in the subject of your email request. Thank you for listening to Gay and Grey Live. We are here every second Wednesday at 5 p.m.
Oh, hey, Mark. How's it going?
Oh, Amy. Hi.
It's nice to see you. You know, I haven't really seen you lately. You know, where have you been? I miss you.
Oh, you know, I get so busy.
Wait, why are you turning the music down? What have you been listening to?
Oh, Amy, I can't lie. It's CKUT 90.3 FM.
90.3 FM? Like, in Montreal?
It's just so good.
Wait, is it better than...
Yes.
Help us spread the word. CKUT is looking for someone to join our team as the chair of the board of directors. Our board of directors reads the fine print, approves the annual budget, engages in community outreach, and keeps CKUT's eye on the bigger picture. The board meets for 2 hours every month, and the chair circulates agendas, keeps meetings organized, and acts as a liaison between the outside world and the board. If you're passionate about the station, this is an opportunity to help lead CKUT into a new era of community media. For more information, please send a message to admin@ckut.ca.
Kristen Carter, my debut contemporary pop album Full Bloom is now yours to discover. Full Bloom is a living garden of 12 songs that celebrates the beauty and the seasonal nature of life. You can find Full Bloom wherever you listen to music. Visit thekristencarter.com or follow @KristenCarterMusic for more. Funded by Factor and Canada's private radio broadcasters.
If you're in the 50 plus age bracket, that means you have experiences, skills, stories to tell. We want to help you tell those stories.
Consider becoming a podcaster? It's easier than you think, and it's a great way to share your experiences with others.
To learn more, contact your local campus and community radio station
or visit podcastingforseniors.ca.
Now everyone's got stories to tell.
Thanks to everyone who donated to CKUT's annual funding drive. Your generosity truly helps keep our engines burning. It's never too late to donate. You can do so by calling 514-907-9424 or going to ckut.ca and hit the green Make a Pledge button at the top. All paid entries will be entered into a grand prize draw. You can pay your pledge and pick up your gift weekdays between 11 to 6 p.m. or by appointments. Call 514-907-9424. Thank you.
Les changements des lois fédérales et provinciales rendent difficile la préparation de vos rapports d'impôts? La solution, Bureau Comptable Cola. Des professionnels chevronnés travaillent avec rigueur pour vous sauver de l'argent ou vous aider à recevoir le maximum de votre rapport d'impôt à un prix compétitif.
Vous êtes dans la grande région de Montréal et ses environs?
Confiez vos rapports d'impôts personnels et d'entreprise au Bureau Comptable Cola.
Appelez dès maintenant le 514-374-0137. Chez Bureau Comptable Cola,
votre comptable travaille pour vous.
you are listening to See, I can see it. CKUT in Montreal.
Hey, Bob, we're recording. Oh, hello, this is Joe reporting here, reporting for CKUT, and I'm downtown, and we're taking a little informal survey here. There's one. Sir, yes, you, sir. Could you please tell me why you listen to CKUT?
Oh, I don't know why I love you like I do. Oh, I don't know why, but I do. Oh, I don't know why I love you like I do. I don't know why, but I do. La, 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 romantic. Oh, it's the one we're all together dancing. Oh, I don't know why. Oh, I love you like I do. Oh, I don't know why, but I do.
CKUT 90.3 FM.